Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The fallout continues from the raid on Mar-a-Lago, the release of the portion of the search warrant, property receipt, basically. And then, of course, the fight over what will or will not be released as it pertains to the affidavit that provides the government's case for probable cause to initiate the raid in the first place. So that will come this week with the Department of Justice asking the court to redact the parts of the affidavit it wants to make sure are not released to the public, and then the judge in the case will make the decision on what the public can see and not see.
And Trump's attorney, I should say, and they're going to court today to try to get a mediator to find out what evidence that they could get back to Mar-a-Lago that's not part of this investigation.
Merrick Garland, writing about Merrick Garland, Jonathan Turley at The Hill, Garland has yet another opportunity to show leadership and reassure the public by ordering substantive disclosures in the proposed redacted affidavit justifying the raid. If not, this will be, I don't have to go through them all, but this will be the fifth missed opportunity to demonstrate that the DOJ deserves the public's trust. Yeah. And this has become part of the back and forth since the raid happened, which is how we're talking about this and the criticisms leveled at the FBI, and it's the typical play of the left that any rhetoric that's critical from the right somehow is the predicate for violence. It's dangerous. It's threatening our democracy and so on and so forth, which is why I thought it was interesting. Dan Crenshaw, congressman from Texas, who often draws the ire of the right, he doesn't really get along with Marjorie Taylor Greene and some others. He's been willing to be critical. He hasn't always been, 100% in response to the left. But this is what he had to say with Jake Tapper about the raid.
It's hard to justify what the Department of Justice did here, in my opinion. And here's why. Here's what it really boils down to. It's not a question that it's bad to have classified material in a non-SCIF environment, right? That's a non-secret compartmentalized infrastructure there. That's wrong. But there's ways to mitigate that. There's ways to resolve that issue. And I still haven't seen any evidence that Trump was even asked to give these documents back. He's been cooperating with them on these issues for a while now, for months. And so why take it to this extreme extent? And I think that's why you're seeing so much backlash from Republicans. You're seeing everyone coalesce. It doesn't matter what side of the issue they're on with Trump. You've seen a lot coalesce around this one because it does seem unjust. And there does seem to be a long history of loss of credibility at the Department of Justice at the hands of Democrats. And I think people are rightfully frustrated about that. And you know that we are going after an ex-president who may run again, that this is automatically political. You cannot separate the legal aspects of this from the political aspects of it. You can't. And it doesn't seem to me like they've acted responsibly as a result of that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
That's a fairly unequivocal statement from Dan Crenshaw, which is encouraging, even if you have issues with Crenshaw. And, it's fine when there's some differences of opinion and you hash them out within your ranks, and that's been the case with Crenshaw. He did have something else to say, though, about some of the rhetoric, because here's what the left does. When it comes to matters like this, any criticism of the FBI that is beyond the pale, like advocating violence, anyone anywhere who says something intemperate, every Republican needs to respond to that. So a one-off comment from anybody perceived to be center-right, every Republican office holder from president to dog catcher in the country is compelled to respond to that. You have to denunciate it, otherwise you're suborning violence or the rhetoric that precedes violence. And so when you listen to this exchange between Tapper and Crenshaw, just remember, there's a major difference. And this is where an area where I disagree with Crenshaw. There's a major difference between defund the police and consider shutting down the FBI and standing up something fresh and new that people can have more faith in. It bring a reckoning to the table. So just think about that, the comparison. On the one hand, a one-off comment, every Republican needs to respond. It can essentially be a plank in the party platform, defund police, on the left, and nobody has to respond to it. Because, of course, the D.C. press corps is the comm shop of the left.
And I loved what Dan Crenshaw said during the interview. And I don't know if you have it, but he said, do any of you really believe Donald Trump is reading nuclear secrets at his bedside at night?
Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of your favorites, who called to defund the FBI after the Mar-a-Lago raid. Federal prosecutors have since charged a Pennsylvania man this week after he wrote on social media, if you work on for the FBI, you deserve to die. Obviously, that armed man tried to enter the FBI office in Ohio. There's a Republican congressional candidate, Carl Paladino, endorsed by Elise Stefanik, who said that Attorney General Merrick Garland should probably be executed. I mean, that rhetoric, I'm sure, bothers you.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. And it makes us seem like extremist Democrats, right? And so Marjorie and AOC can go join the Defund the Law Enforcement Club if they want. 99% of Republicans are not on that train. What we want is accountability. We want transparency. And the criticisms that we're leveling against the FBI and DOJ are fully warranted. It is not those criticisms that lead to a crazy person, attacking an FBI.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about people who are, like, saying, kill FBI or...
No, it's completely wrong, right? It's completely wrong, but that's not where 99% of Republicans are at, of course. And I'll tell you what frustrates Republicans when you hear that kind of criticism is, last time I checked, you had even the White House spokesperson saying, yes, people should be out protesting in front of Supreme Court justices' homes, even after Brett Kavanaugh, that is life threatened by this. And so, there's a double standard that frustrates the Republicans quite a bit when we talk about these issues.
Crenshaw's absolutely right about that.
100%.
This is the point I was getting to. Yeah, absolutely right about that. And also too, Jake Tapper, like, don't we need to denounce people who say the attorney general should be executed? Yeah, Jake.
Yeah.
Nobody is advocating violence here. No serious person is advocating violence. Nobody wants to see any law enforcement officers hurt or targeted. Nobody wants to, just like nobody wants, no reasonable, serious person wants to see a Supreme Court justice assassinated. So can we just dispense with all of the things that are obvious among serious people and focus on the substance of the matter? Because the thing he did with the AOC and Marjorie Taylor Greene can go join the defund law enforcement movement. I'm not a particular fan of Marjorie Taylor Greene, okay? But talking about the FBI's ongoing existence, bringing that into question, is not the same thing as the left's defund the police movement, which persists to this day. Those are not equivalents. And I don't like that Crenshaw made them equivalents because he doesn't like Marjorie Taylor Greene. We had legitimate discussions. I mean, deep thinkers, academicians, civil rights and civil liberties attorneys like Harvey Silverglate, we spoke with last week, having serious conversations about what the FBI should look like, what its scope of mission should be. Does that need to be reconsidered? Does that need to be reined in? The national security function, getting back to cops and robbers. Is it a corporate culture problem or just a senior leadership problem? These are legitimate questions. So on the one hand, Crenshaw says these criticisms lodged in the direction of DOJ and FBI are perfectly legitimate. And then he says, well, if you want to essentially, as I said, bring the FBI to, take the FBI apart and reconstitute it into something that people can have more confidence in. That's somehow part of the defund law enforcement. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. That is not the same thing as defund police. Mm-hmm. Nobody is saying, nobody from conservative law and order perspective is saying that. We're start from the premise that a lot of those functions need to be carried out by some federal law enforcement agency. But now we need to talk about what that should look like, given the history of the FBI over the last 30 years. And frankly, when you start folding in the J. Edgar Hoover ever, the history of the FBI for much of its existence, these are legitimate topics of inquiry, just as we would have a legitimate conversation, and we are now, about the CDC and other federal that we've had for a long time about the DOE, both DOEs, education and energy and so forth, ever since they were stood up. These do not redound to our founding. These agencies are 100 years old in the case of the FBI and some of these other agencies I just mentioned, much newer than that, dating back to the Nixon and Carters. I mean, come on. This idea that they're untouchable. They're untouchable only to the extent that they're mutable. And that's the question and the discussion, questions being raised and the discussion we're having now.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Researchers at the Institute of Government Studies at UC Berkeley looked at activity levels in the downtown areas of major cities between March and May and compared those activity levels to pre-pandemic levels. The cities with the least amount of activity as compared to pre-pandemic: Cleveland, 36% downtown recovery. Portland, 41% downtown recovery. And right behind them, Detroit and Chicago's downtown areas with 42 and 43% recovery, respectively. Look out, Chicago. Detroit is coming for us.
312-642-5600. Turnkey Depro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Remember when we talked about this? And because I used to work and live in Detroit. And I said, eventually, from what I'm seeing, I think Chicago is going to become Detroit. And you said, as long as Ken Griffin lives here, we will not become Detroit.
Well, it's more than Ken Griffin. And we're not Detroit.
Yet.
Not yet. Right. But so there's still a ways to go because our economy is a lot more diversified than Detroit's. And so the fall is not going to be as precipitous. It's going to be a slow and steady decline, which we're right in the middle of.
Yeah. I mean, never in your lifetime did you ever think you'd walk down prestigious Michigan Avenue and see stores that were boarded up and see stores that are vacant, you know, for lease on a very, you know, a main thoroughfare like that. I just never in my life would thought we'd see that.
That's what the researchers at Berkeley suggest. A lot of the lack of activity is tied to the lessening demand for downtown real estate because of remote work, but also because I don't want to do business in a city that's lawless anymore. That's definitely a part of it, too. And you see that with the cities that are the worst performers in terms of post-pandemic recovery.
You can only get looted so many times. I mean, before the Disney store closed down, I had a friend that was a manager there, and she used to pick up poops that people would leave in the front foyer. Well, it wasn't the city's problem because it was technically on their property, so she'd have to pick it up. It was disgusting.
Uh-huh. And, of course, the violence continues. That is a proximate cause of the lack of recovery. People don't want to go downtown, particularly from the suburbs. You hear this routinely. And over the weekend, we had 7 kids shot within the span of 17 hours. We have more stories. More stories about what is to come statewide, including for you and your suburban enclaves. January 1, I'm going to go back to the Safety Act. Prosecutors say a man who shot and killed another guest at a Logan Square quinceañera had a warrant out for his arrest because he failed to show up in court after he violated probation in an armed carjacking case. So there you go. He's out for a felony, and he allegedly shoots and kills somebody at Logan Square. We mentioned this, and we'll mention it again, and we'll keep mentioning it. In 2021, 74 people who were accused of shooting or killing someone out on electronic monitoring attempted to shoot or kill or did shoot or kill another person. Those 74 people who were out, who should have been in awaiting trial, were responsible for another 111 crime victims while on electronic monitoring. 111 easily preventable crimes detain violent criminals pending trial. But we won't do it. The Democrat socialists in charge of the city and the state, they won't do it. And every week there's a story like this guy who killed a guy at a Logan Square party over the weekend.
In New York, I don't know if you guys saw it, it's gone viral. A black man, you know, in the Bronx is just standing behind this white guy, innocent victim. He's got a, you know, a backpack on, looks like a tourist. We don't know for sure. They haven't released his name, but he sucker punches him. The guy immediately falls to the ground, cracks skull. He's in a coma still. And this guy was released. He was originally charged with attempted murder, and then the charges were downgraded by prosecutors to a misdemeanor assault and harassment. Oh, he was harassed, all right. And so once that video went viral, people were outraged. People in the Bronx, people, members of the media, like, how could you let, he's out. And so Governor Hochul had him rearrested Friday afternoon. Now she's acting like she's the big hero because, you know, she's taken the law and she's taken matters into her own hands. But I just wonder if you think Governor Pritzker would do that here. If something went viral like that, that he would stand up and
what do you mean?
Somebody rearrested?
How many crimes have gone viral? There's viral video of crimes every frickin' week.
Yeah,
do I think you do that? Oh, if we ever have a crime where there's video and it goes viral, what are you talking about? Film State Street any weekend night. The kid, the culinary student, we got a video of him being shot for over his whatever it was, his iPhone. I mean, every viral video of crime got nothing but Pritzker.
Yeah.
Chicago tracking to, you know, for all this, murders down a tick. And so, hey, things are looking up, really. 1,848 carjackings in the city in 2021. We're tracking for nearly 2,000 this year. You want to go police district by police district? I do. Maybe this will focus people's attention. So, because when they hear the city of Chicago, they think, oh, west and south sides. They don't think, oh, where I live. Well, it is where you live. Do that in just a second. Matt in Mount Greenwood, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I was out to dinner Friday night with a sibling who was a court reporter. We were actually at a restaurant outside of the city. Although I live in the city, we refuse to go to dinner in the city anymore. However, she's a court reporter. She was telling me and us that in light of all the resignations, the high-profile ones that we're hearing of, the prosecutors, there are plenty of judges who are retiring early. This year, She said 30% of the judges that she is dealing with will be retired by the end of this year, if not next year. And these are people who tend to be a little bit more conservative. So watch out, everybody. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Yeah, same thing. I played golf with a police detective over the weekend.
Yeah.
And he says the I think he's been on the job for 12 years or so. The conversation inside police is the same conversation like that's in Illinois generally.
Are you leaving?
Yeah, well, what's my exit strategy? He's got 12 years on. I said, are you going to do 20 and get out? He said, if that. I'm looking to get out. And everybody is talking about getting out. So that's not a good culture if that's the attitude of people on the job with the experience. So sort of the same thing at the circuit court level that Matt's talking about. Uh-huh. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about crime in the Tony neighborhoods in Chicago. Matt Rosenberg over at Wire Points did a nice summary piece where he looked at this district by district. So, for example, in the 20th Police District, which is most of Edgewater, looking at crime 2019, so pre-pandemic to 2022, this is a safe neighborhood. There was one murder in 2022. There was none in 2019. So this is generally a safe neighborhood. But what you see is robbery is up 35%. Theft is up 118%. Motor vehicle theft, 44%. This is where the carjackings come in. It's citywide. In the 19th district, this is south of Edgewater, city's neighborhoods of Uptown and Lakeview.
Yeah, that's my district.
Murders up 250%. Robberies up 54%.
Oh, great.
Thefts up 43%. Motor vehicle theft, 82%. The carjackings again. Now, again, on the murder, I don't want to overstate the case because there's no need. Two murders in 2019, seven in 2022. But it's still
it's a lot.
Something.
Seven murders. Wow.
District 18, Lincoln Park, Gold Coast, Old Town, Streeterville, River North. That's my hood.
The Star District, that's what we call it.
Yeah,
district, all the celebrities live in the 18th.
District 18.
Pritzker is in the 18th.
So do I. Murder, 75% increase from 4 in 2019 to 7. Criminal sexual assault, 56% increase. Motor vehicle theft, 132% increase.
That's surprising.
How about District 24? District 24. Make sure I got my districts lined up. Yeah, that's Rogers Park to Edgewater's immediate north.
Okay.
Motor vehicle theft, 48% increase 2019 to 2022. 77% increase in theft overall. 43% increase in aggravated battery. 7% increase in criminal sexual assault. 33% increase, I should say, in murder. But again, that's from 3 to 4. And then District 1, which runs South Lakefront from the Chicago River downtown south to 31st Street. Murder increased 400%. Robbery increased 41%. Motor vehicle theft increased 284%.
Jeez.
You went from...
That's the worst one of all.
Motor vehicle theft, 169 in 2019 to 649
Jeez.
In 2022.
All in one district?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what's happening in neighborhoods that don't include Inglewood or Austin. Trying to give you an indication with the help of our friends at Wire Points that the violent crime, because carjacking is violent crime, a lot of these thefts end up being violent crime, have all the indicia of violent crime. 2,000 carjackings, they're spread across the city, of course. They're not all happening in the, in fact, fewer on a per capita basis happening in some of the poorer neighborhoods that are beset by violent crime. Citywide. It's a citywide problem. You have a citywide morale problem with police. The stuff I'm hearing about David Brown is laughable. What a
He has no respect from anybody.
What a figurehead he is. You know, somebody told me that he's got a big, he ordered a big screen TV.
For his office?
And he plays video games. Maybe he can have, if that's true, maybe he can have Kim Fox's husband over.
But he doesn't care, too. I mean, if you go to these press conferences, you could see he is so checked out. Again, his heart is in Texas.
Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, my buddy's got his uncle, like that Gran Torino guy, that Clint Eastwood, that movie, in the neighborhoods. And we went up there about 5 years ago to do some work on his house. And that place is loaded full of pheasants. Somebody dumped a bunch of pheasants out there. They're over there by the thousands. And I think they should open up hunting in Detroit, because if you went to go to shoot, you wouldn't hit any, like, a glass or a window, because all the glass and windows are blown out of the houses anyway. But if you ever get a chance to get up there and figure out a way to catch them, it'd be a lot of fun. Thank you.
Well, last time I was there, they raised a number of homes, and they're doing organic farming. They knocked them down, the houses that were abandoned.
Remember the letter? We had him on. David Lampert's the CEO of Lester Lampert, a jeweler downtown in Michigan Avenue, right off Michigan Avenue. It's been there 100 years. Mm-hmm. He wrote this letter in the summer of 2020. Open letter to Lori Lightfoot. It's disheartening to see what our city's become. We're hearing story after story from clients who are afraid to come to the city to see us right now. People are terrified to go out in public. As you can imagine, this isn't good for business. Lampert, whose business employs 25 people, says he supports peaceful demonstrations and freedom of speech, but we must also support law and order, the police, and prosecute criminal activity to the fullest extent of the law. The people committing the acts of violence are emboldened by light sentences and lack of consequences being applied. I fear we are at a tipping point right now. We will either get Chicago back to its great stature amongst the world's finest cities, or delve further into chaos, the likes of which will make Detroit of the 80s and 90s look like paradise. So that was 2 years ago. Which direction are we heading?
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week we had the Illinois State Fair. Maybe some of you attended. And, of course, you always have Republican Day and Democrat Day at the State Fair. Each party gets its day.
Yep.
And the write-up from the hysterical, unintentionally so, Chicago Tribune.
Well, what did they do now?
From Rick Pearson. I mean, to be fair, he was probably drunk when he wrote it. He's there. The headline, State Fair Spotlights Divisive State's Divisive Politics. The fair has long been a celebration of Illinois' cultural diversity. What? What State Fair are you talking about? The one in Springfield?
Hello? Really?
It's an ag festival.
Right.
You know,
People show up, their steer and their pigs and their...
It's agriculture. It's, you know, a butter cow made in tribute to the governor. It's having a fried Snicker on a stick. It's going to listen to Cheap Trick. What are you talking about? Culture, a celebration of cultural diversity at the state fair?
It's the state fair.
This is just a setup. I mean, it's, you know, the...
What's more slamming of the Republican Party to promote their agenda?
The tortured lengths that these people will go to in the Chicago press corps to parrot the hate has no home here rap of the left, because what else do they have to talk about? They can't talk about the quality of life in Illinois. So they have to say, we're standing up against hate and we're saving Illinois and saving our democracy. And so just because Illinois has the third worst unemployment rate in the country, which it's been that way for a long time, even low unemployment rates across the board, but still the third worst. You know, we're at the bottom and everything you want to be at the top of, and we're at the top of everything you want to be at the bottom of. Illinois is still missing 1 in 9 jobs, more than 10% of the jobs that were lost during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we're, but because Darren Bailey spoke to, an event sponsored by Awake Illinois, that's, oh my, divisive politics has taken hold in this state. Right. Divisive politics from the people that bring you identitarianism at every turn, that aided and abetted the rioting that laid waste to Chicago twice in the summer of 2020. All that is to be washed aside. And we need to just parrot hate, hate, hate. I'm anti-hate, you're pro-hate. That's the choice in November, on November 8th. And boy, they really have a low opinion of people. They really have a low opinion of people if they think they can sell that. But I guess they've sold it before, to some extent, with the help of Illinois Republicans. Maybe less likely this time around. Here's what Richard Porter had to say in response to some of the silliness from the left. And just to the point of a Republican Party being unified behind its nominees for governor and other constitutional offices, as well as down the ballot. Remember, Richard Porter, who is the national committeeman for the Illinois Republican Party. Mm-hmm.
Isn't he a Trump delegate?
He's a big time. I don't know if he's a Trump delegate, but a big time downtown lawyer. Was an Irvin supporter, backed Irvin and the slate. But this is what he said at the State Fair on Republican Day.
And that's what Tom has in his arms. And that's what Tom has in his heart. Because, you know, when everybody else was hiding out and bowing down to the tyrant, who stood up? Who stood up for the people of Illinois? Two people, Darren Bailey and Tom DeVore. It takes courage. And I'm so proud to have a guy like Tom DeVore there to represent us, the people. He'll be a lawyer for all the people, not just for the powerful. You think about who he's running against? He's running against the guy that is basically the wingman for Pritzker. He's a lapdog, man. He's a lapdog. We got a bulldog right over here. That man. Darren Bailey together with Tom DeVore, I'll tell you what, we're going to return to constitutional government. We're going to have a governor that's going to work within his lane, and we're going to have an attorney general that's going to go after crime. We're going to do what it takes. He's going to hold people to account. If a prosecutor does not prosecute, this man will find a way to prosecute her. Okay? So we can do that. It's time that the government work for us again. So without further ado, let's meet the man who has got the party's platform on his arms, Tom DeVore.
Yeah, so talking obviously about DeVore, the attorney general nominee, and Bailey. And the key point in there, I mean, there's a lot of points, but the key one is these are two people that stood up when nobody else would stand up, when it was time to stand up with respect to COVID. And here we are with the kiddies back in school, at least at CPS today, and the assessment of what has happened over the last 2 years and where we stand now and what was accomplished by the choices that were made.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA and then a quick comment.
I mean, heavens, I don't want to be divisive.
I mean, please.
Yeah. But
this is a talk show.
Mentioned this last week. We'll mention it again and again and again. Maybe some people now are more receptive to the arguments about what happened than they were during it. Maybe there's some separation now where you can actually reflect on the choices that were made, the lockdowns that were imposed, the results they produced at the costs that were imposed, and say, boy, that was a bad decision. I don't know, but you have to make arguments. And so the baseline of the argument is Illinois had the fifth highest number of cases and the eighth highest number of deaths in the country.
With all those mitigations in place?
We're down.
We couldn't go to restaurants. Remember that? You had to order out for months, and then it came back in, then it came out. Couldn't go to the gym. Couldn't go to church.
We're down more than 10% of the jobs we had in the state pre-pandemic.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, the numbers are rolling in all over the country. We'll be talking about them region by region because test scores and any way to measure academic progress are all down. And they're most persistently and dramatically down among minority students, where there has been very little recovery, very little catch up over the last 2 years. And so on kids' academic performance, on kids, the incidence of mental health issues with kids, on the economic indicators. And what did we accomplish? Because at the state fair, you had Governor Buttercow up there talking about how he saved lives and livelihoods.
Screaming like an unhinged man.
Here's a question.
I thought he was.
Here's a question too for those COVIDians and those who want to sort of persist because they need to justify their own conduct over those 2 years. In addition to, and so they, so by extension, they feel the need to rationalize Pritzker's. Here's a thought experiment. Last week, as we discussed, Dr. Rochelle Walensky said the CDC's response to COVID did not reliably meet expectations, and she's announced calls to reorganize the entire agency.
Yeah, and called for a special forces too, in case there's another outbreak.
So at the state and city level in Illinois and Chicago, all you had was Pritzker and Ezekiel, Lightfoot and Arwady implementing whatever the CDC guidance was.
Yeah, that was their Bible. That was their playbook.
That's all they did.
And there was no attribution, like, where are you getting studies on, you know, the efficiencies of masks? There was nothing there.
So,
they told me to Google it.
So explain something to me. How can the CDC director say the agency's response did not reliably meet expectations and those that just Simon Says whatever the CDC said did meet expectations? How does Pritzker and Lightfoot explain? How do they explain the CDC didn't meet expectations, but we did following the CDC lockstep? That can't be true. That cannot be true. So either Rochelle Walensky is wrong or Pritzker and Lightfoot are wrong. So who's wrong? Fifth highest number of cases, eighth highest number of deaths. So what was accomplished? Virginia, the differences test scores. Two-thirds of students passed math exams last year, compared to 82% before the pandemic, from 82 to 66. Racial and economic disparities also widened. white and Asian students making more progress toward their pre-pandemic levels than black and Hispanic students. Passage rates remain more than 20 points behind pre-pandemic levels in math for black, Hispanic, and economically disadvantaged students and among students learning English. All groups fared better in reading than they did math, but state officials said that was due to the fact that standards were lowered in 2021. Why they did that is a separate conversation, because that makes no sense. But so is that your experience? Or when you start to see that, maybe when the kids are back in school, and I'm not just talking about CPS, will that resonate? Will that call for some reconsideration? I don't know. You just wonder. You just wonder what you're going to do in terms of holding people to account for some of the most important policy choices that were ever made and for how dramatically wrong they got those decisions. And the evidence just continues to mount, doesn't it? So are you going to...
You think things are going to be better this year?
Are you going to mea culpa it? And say, or maybe you don't even blame yourself. If you don't want to blame yourself for going along, that's fine. At least do the honorable thing and blame the people who made the decisions and the destruction those decisions wrought. That's the least you can do.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and let me give you an example of what I was just talking about in terms of being able to pivot when the evidence becomes overwhelming. It's okay. Just pivot to the right place and we'll dispense with having to remind people about the place from which you came. Well, with some exceptions, like Dr. Leanna Wen. She was the top abortionist at Planned Parenthood for a while. Regular CNN contributor on the topic of COVID, of course.
Oh yeah, she was their darling there for a while, and she wouldn't get her kids vaccinated. I remember that.
And this is what she said back in September of last year, about vaccine mandates.
We need to start looking at the choice to remain unvaccinated the same as we look at driving while intoxicated. That you have the option to not get vaccinated if you want, but then you can't go out in public. Because when you go out in public, you have the potential of infecting other people with a potentially deadly disease. Just like you can choose to drink in private if you want, but if you get behind the wheel of a car and can endanger other people, there is an obligation by society to prevent you from doing that. So I think what President Biden did today is exactly right, to say that the vaccinated should not have to pay the price for the so-called choices of the unvaccinated anymore. Although to your point, Chris, I definitely wished that he had also announced some type of proof of vaccination, because at this point we have this flimsy piece of paper that's so easy to counterfeit. Mm-hmm. And I mean we don't allow this to board an airplane, right? You don't go to the TSA right. checkpoint and say, I am who I say I am. Here's a piece of paper right. where I wrote my name.
Some
I mean,
states,
we have
though.
ID for this reason.
Yeah, back
oh,
then.
My goodness.
Back then in the heady days of pandemic of the unvaccinated. Remember that?
Yeah.
And vilifying the unvaccinated. She said the unvaccinated should not be allowed to leave their homes.
But do you understand what a hypocrite she is? We should find this audio. I remember we played it. When the vaccines were approved then for kids 5 and younger, she went on CNN. She's like, nah, I'm not going to get my kids vaccinated. Like, what? You said one thing a year ago, and now you're saying something else. Because when it pertains to your kids, you want to have choice. But the rest of us didn't have a choice.
Last week,
oh my God.
The same Dr. Leanna Wen
yeah.
had this to say.
Uh-oh.
Everyone should choose the level of precaution appropriate to their family situation without judgment. I'm concerned about those who advocate for broad restrictions for all publicly, but don't live those values in their personal lives. That hurts trust in public health. I guess La Rochefoucauld was right that hypocrisy is the tribute that virtue pays to vice. So... yeah, Leanna Wen is moving with the winds, and that's obvious. But that's what a lot of people are going to need to do if there's going to be a reckoning for the COVIDian politicians. they're going to have to make the Lena Wynn pivot to be generous. And that's okay. That's okay. Just make sure you do it. Because, you know, based on the evidence, you sort of owe us one, don't you think? Or are you just going to ignore this and pretend like I'm just glad it's over and there's no accounting required?
So I think that's what a lot of people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's back to normal. Why are you still complaining? There's no, you know, test to stay anymore. But still, if you get COVID, you have to, you're locked out of a government school building for 5 days if you tell them the truth that you have COVID.
Yeah.
You don't have any symptoms. It's stupid.
The impact is what you should be looking at. The impact that is not arguable and cannot be glossed over. Where your kids are in school. Who do you blame that on? I mean, we're talking about COVIDians. You're not going to blame it on the teachers. You're not going to blame it on the school. You love your government schools. You love your teachers' unions. What? Who's at fault? Conservatives aren't in charge. So how do you blame us? Where do you go? Test scores? Just give you a few examples. DuPage County, all 36 school districts that were reviewed in a study that DuPage Policy Journal did, showed significant student declines in scores for tests taken in 21 versus 2019. Districts seeing the greatest declines, DuPage County. Indian Prairie School District 204 saw test failure rates of 20% in math and 25% in English, 20 failure rate increases. Glen Ellyn Community Consolidated School District 89 saw test failure rates increase by 35% in math and 25% in English. Cass School District 63 saw test failure rates increase 17% in math and 29% in English. Benjamin School District 25 saw test failure rates increase 24% in math and 27% in English. This is consistent with what, you know, left-leaning think tanks like the Brookings Institute observed. Devastating impacts on student learning. I mean, this is the scholarship everywhere. Try to find a study, whether it's at an individual school district, at state level, or nationally, that talks about the wonderful things that were accomplished by locking down the schools. Because you don't have the prevented death and illness anymore, do you?
No.
So what do you got?
And all those lies. I mean, I think they all owe us an apology for lying and saying if you get the vaccine, you won't get it or you won't spread it, which is a lie.
I don't need an apology.
I want them all fired.
I need people to, the form of the apology you should take,
what?
Vote to remove those in charge. Just vote to remove those in charge, period.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I did want to make a note that when we were talking about crime before, I forgot to mention Chicago is starting to get more serious about combating violent crime. You know how I know?
How do you know? What's going on?
The rapper Twista is coming in to host a celebrity basketball game to stop the violence.
Oh, Twista?
Twista, yeah.
I'm not familiar with Twista's work.
Yeah, I think you are. You probably
Justin,
just don't know
Twista?
It. Twista's been around for a while.
Okay.
But
that'll stop. That'll stop. And over the weekend, they had a gun buyback program, $100 Visa gift card.
Mm.
If you give back a weapon, air guns and replicas worth $10. So it's going to stop it.
Yeah, it's going well. The reorg of the CDC that was announced by Dr. Rochelle Walensky last week, the admissions, and again, I just repeat the thought experiment. All those COVIDians, none are being asked. None of these COVIDian governors have been asked. But how can Rochelle Walensky say the CDC did not reliably meet expectations and talk about the lack of transparency when you hear from Dr. Birx the lack of a lot more than just transparency? How can that be true? And yet those COVIDian governors did everything right and saved lives and livelihoods when all they were doing was rinsing and repeating whatever pronouncements the CDC offered. That can't be the case. Okay. Something to consider. We got it wrong, but the people who listened to us and did exactly what we told them to do got it right. How does that work?
It doesn't work.
Dr. Deborah Birx did a wonderful job on Face the Nation this weekend of pretending that she was not part of the pandemic response during the Trump years.
I watched it. Like,
who is this Deborah Birx?
Who?
Noted immunologist Deborah Birx on the reorg. No, I mean, she definitely agrees with the need for CDC to be reorganized. She took her a while to say it, like she had to get her book done and, you know, be back in the public pitching her wares before she could say anything or volunteer the idea. She waited for Rochelle Walensky to fall on that sword.
To be frank, quote, we are responsible for some pretty dramatic, pretty public mistakes, from testing to data to communications. This is our watershed moment. And she outlined these proposed changes to institutional culture, accountability, communication, timeliness. Do you agree, doctor, with her diagnosis?
I'm thrilled that she had Jim McRae and did this work, because a lot of directors would have just tried to tweak. And tweaking the agency at this point was not going to be successful. This is an inflection point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Some other things that Birx had to say to underscore the need for a reorganization. And by the way, that statement that Margaret Brennan read from Rochelle Walensky, that's some statement. We made mistakes on testing, on data, etc. But again, Pritzker and Lightfoot made no mistakes. Reconcile those two statements for me, won't you?
Well, they'll never admit that they made any mistakes. They don't say the M word, Dan. And the data that they were getting wasn't even from American hospitals. It was from Europe.
That's what Deborah Birx said.
First and foremost, in March of 2020, all of our data that I used to warn Americans of who was at risk for severe disease, hospitalization, and death came from our European colleagues. That in itself should be an indictment of our system. Secondly, reporting was coming in extraordinarily slow from hospitals through a system that CDC had created. And I know this created controversy, but for 3 months, I asked the CDC to fix its system and develop a partnership with clinics and hospitals and laboratories, and they wouldn't. And so that's why I asked all the hospitals to start reporting, and they did. And so I think sometimes we hold ourselves back. The private sector is willing to help us.
So then how did Redfield and Fauci factor into all this? Because
I hope she asked her that.
But she didn't. The latter, Fauci's still around. Why was the CDC so flat-footed then? This is Walensky said this is a watershed moment. The watershed moment was the response and the preparation for the response, so they were unprepared. And then they were recalcitrant. They played guard the fiefdom rather than problem solve. And by the way, the other issue they didn't get to, which she should be put on point on, what they did to scientists with whom they disagreed or who disagreed with them. Equally credentialed scientists who disagreed.
Yeah, their coworkers disagree. Cancel them. Take them off social media. Do whatever you can to make their life hell.
On the issue of guidances that were taken and implemented by COVIDian politicians like Pritzker and Lightfoot.
If you're going to issue guidance, like the 5 days and return to work in a mask, show the data transparently that you utilized to come to that decision. Because I think when Americans saw that it was a very small number, that they would have really reconsidered those guidelines. And so you really need the information. Americans are smart. They can process the information. Give them all of the data.
Right. Well, where's the data that says if somebody in CPS, somebody in your class or on your team has COVID, regardless of vaccination, you have to wear a mask for 10 days? based on what? What exactly? Who said that that would be effective or efficient? And who's going to be the masking police? Because mark my word, Dan, in 3 weeks from now, everyone at CPS is going to be masked again. Because somebody's going to have it.
I don't recall Deborah Birx providing any disclosures of this sort when she was, you know, riding point along with Fauci in the first year of the pandemic. Most of the first year of it. I don't recall that. I recall a lot of shut up and wear your mask, shut up and get your jab. That's what I recall. And she was a part of it or silent on the topic until now, until the announcement of the reorganization. Now it's all about show your work. Now it's now we're going back to the scientific method. Okay, well, that's welcome if that's real. But again, the reckoning for what was done, the decisions that were made. You know, don't apologize to me. Apologize to the Great Barrington Declaration drafters and signatories. Apologize to the Jay Bhattacharyas and the John Ioannidises of the world. Martin Kulldorff, Sunetra Gupta. Yeah. The issue of guidance is be transparent, show your work. Respond to studies that suggest you're making the wrong decision. Distill studies that draw competing results in terms of what policy to follow. Have that wide discussion. If you believe that Americans are smart and that's just not something you say on a talk show, then present your work and also contemplate and respond to studies or scientists who offer a substantive disagreement on the policy recommendations you're making. That never happened. Never happened. In point of fact, just to remember, because I this is important to remember. People who want to move on, you're wrong. You can't do that. You can't move on from a crime scene without addressing the crime that was committed.
Yep.
And obtaining a bit of justice. In fact, we know from email exchanges, Francis Collins to Tony Fauci, it was essentially go after those people who were disagreeing, smart, accomplished people who were disagreeing, go after them, shut them up. Not verbatim, but that was the implication of the communication between the two. There needs to be a reckoning for things like that if you want a culture change. And I'm not just talking about CDC. I'm talking about within the scientific community generally, or we're going to have a scientific community of one. Tony Fauci is science. To disagree with him is to disagree with science. One of the most incredible statements that's ever been made by a scientist in the history of the world.
And yet he still continues to work.
Staggering. John in Naperville.
Yeah, the part that's scariest to me is that they're still following these false things, i.e. all the military that does not want to get the jab, or all the, you know, federal workers that don't want to get the jab. It is a shame. And the only way that these people are going to be held accountable, Dan and Amy, is if they get personally sued. Fauci should have a civil suit brought against him by all these people that he silenced. Every single one, sue him for every single penny he's got.
Thanks for the call.
I know, he didn't care.
John.
I mean, he didn't have kids in school or grandkids. He didn't care. He was making money. He was sitting at baseball games throwing out the first pitch. I mean, they became celebrities. Remember, he didn't have a mask on, too? It's like, oh, keep telling us to wear a mask.
No, I remember. Yeah. I started wearing scarves like Deborah Birx, you know, just wanted to get into it.
You channeled your inner Dr. Birx.
Birx on how to change the CDC culture. It's interesting, too. We can have this conversation across party lines about changing the CDC culture because of what Walensky volunteered. And yet, if we try to have that conversation about the FBI, you're being shouted down as some sort of defund law enforcement crank. Birx on the CDC culture.
Well, the way you rebuild public trust is be transparent. And I think that's in the report. Better data, better accountability, better transparency. But they also have to believe, and this gets to the culture piece, people can understand complicated issues. It's your job as a public health official. That's what public and public health means. Your job is to take complex situations and data and create graphs so that people can understand why you are making those recommendations. Recommendations that are created out of lack of transparency and out of a black box where you can't really follow the logic is what leads to fracturing and trust.
Yeah, that's one of the things. And then people who raise questions or even objections are told that they're killing grandma and grandpa. That also tends to fracture trust in productive dialogue. You know what I mean?
Divided families. People got divorced over that. I mean, seriously, people lost friends that they've had for 40 plus years over this. Neighbors they don't talk to anymore. It destroyed our culture. People didn't go to Thanksgivings and Christmases for 2 years. And don't forget who did it to you come November and come February.
Sarah, Glenview.
Yeah, hi. Governor Pritzker, this is insult to injury. I want us all to remember that while he was imposing lockdowns here, we had the visual of his wife and daughter enjoying freedom in free states. I'm sure you remember that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
He got him out the day before he locked us down the first time. And then, you know, our kids could play sport, but there she is on her horse jumping around.
Well, yeah.
But on her Instagram, living her life, that's fine. At least she had a choice because she lived in a place where she had freedoms called Florida. And every politician, every Democrat politician in this country was sent their family there or went there themselves for vacations to enjoy freedoms that they didn't have in their own states under their own laws that they created.
The lesson is get your kids into equestrian sports. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, the only reform that needs to happen to the CDC is it needs to be disbanded. It is probably more responsible than any institution in our country in the last 2 years for destroying the confidence that people have in their own government. I mean, there's this notion now that many people don't trust or think that their government is working against them, and it's because of the CDC.
Yep.
And other institutions have been destroyed either as well. Look at hospitals and your doctor, your relationship with your doctor. I personally trust my doctor, but, you know, other ones I don't know. I have a jaundiced eye at this point. I really do, towards hospitals. I mean, with all of the incentives that the federal government gave them for various different things related to COVID and all these CDC recommendations they were following, that whole institution needs to be completely disbanded, and everybody in that organization needs to be fired and or let go or reassigned somewhere else. But that is it. That end the CDC completely. Defund it, disband it. No more.
I don't know what I hate more, the FBI or the CDC.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Nearly 5 million illegal immigrants have crossed the border in the last 18 months, in the 18 months since Joe Biden has been in office.
And they keep coming. They're not stopping.
Oh, they also include that number, nearly 5 million, includes some 900,000, quote unquote, gotaways who evaded apprehension and have since disappeared into America. It's a lot of people. And remember, when we talk about this in the context of the FBI, we talk about dozens of individuals on the terrorist watch list who the FBI believes have been able to gain entry into this country one way or the other, and we don't know where they are. The president of Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, roughly the equivalent of the entire population of Ireland has illegally entered the United States in the last 18 months. Maybe if we couch it that way, people get more serious because the last thing we need is 5 million more Irish.
Hey, stop.
Thank you very much.
Be nice.
Dan Crenshaw was asked about the issue at the border and whether or not he supported issues at the border, whether or not he supported Greg Abbott, Texas Governor Greg Abbott's stunt, if you will, of sending migrants to New York City. And this is what Crenshaw had to say about it.
This is a move of desperation to get someone to pay attention to what we're dealing with in Texas, you know, which is why I support it. Yeah, so will they have a more likelihood of staying in the country? Look, basically everyone who's crossing our border has that same likelihood. There's almost 2 million, I think, we're at apprehensions just this year. That's an unprecedented number. Huge amount of those will stay in the country because the backlogs in our system are so severe that that's going to happen anyway. And when we're talking about the New York and D.C. busing, we're talking about a few thousand immigrants. That's what we deal with on a daily basis in South Texas. So, look, what he's doing, I think, is out of desperation, and it's highly necessary because somebody has to solve this problem. This is an infringement on our sovereignty. It's an infringement on our rule of law. And you know what? It's unfair and it's immoral to the millions upon millions of good law-abiding immigrants or asylum seekers around the world that have no chance of getting into our system because of the backlog that people are creating because they're geographically close to the United States and they can just walk across. It's not fair.
And it's also wait a second, why the rejection? Why not the embrace? Your sanctuary city, your sanctuary state, this is what you want. This is the policies. You believe in open borders. So why not? This is your best case scenario. How can sanctuary cities and sanctuary states be bitching about receiving people in this country illegally? You don't believe in the rule of law, right? People aren't illegal, in the famous words of AOC. And then we can see, and everybody can see on full display, as we did in New York over the weekend, hundreds of migrants lined up outside Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx to get healthcare coverage, food, and other items, including school supplies and free phones. Right, exactly. No difference in terms of benefits or rights between those who are in this country legally and those who are legal residents of the United States. And see if the legal residents of the United States think that's the way the society should be organized. Absolutely. It's an experiment, or it's an act of desperation. But it may act of desperation or, attaching consequences that people can see to policy choices that have been made so you can decide if that's really how you want to live. For more on this and other matters, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You know, I think it was on the show. I started talking about this issue in January 2020, and I was putting out estimate numbers at the time. People thought I had horns growing out of my head, and I was just delusional. And it turned out that my estimates were modest. But by the end of Biden's first term, he will have more than doubled the illegal immigration population in the United States, more than doubled it. And if it were a state, it would be one of the largest states in the union. And there's no end in sight. You know, by one estimate, a global poll, they estimated the number of people that wanted to come to the United States if they could, is something like 3 billion. And right now, traffickers are rerouting human trafficking networks all over the world to come to the United States. So this is not only a catastrophic burden on American citizens. And ironically, and nobody really talks about this, who does the burden fall on the most? It actually falls on the most disadvantaged in our society because illegal immigrants are directly competing with them for resources. So homeless populations are marginalized and pushed out because people have to serve illegal immigrants. Food banks, schools, free clinics, everything, every bit of the safety net is being diverted to care for people who are largely here just because they felt like coming. And they jump ahead of the line of everybody else, and they have advantages that American taxpayers are denied.
Yeah, but why is Biden doing this? I mean, is he thinking that this is a way to grow their base of their party?
Well, I think that was a reasonable argument. I mean, if you look back to H.R. 1, which was taking over federal elections. I think they did see a synergy between if they can control federal elections and import all these people illegally, then they can give them all just amnesty, put them on a rapid route to voting, and then they would have a massive voting block that they would that would be beholden to them. I still think that's kind of part of the plan. The hope is, well, someday we'll give all these people amnesty and we'll still do that. But you have to remember, you know, not to be conspiratorial, because it's just not, but George Soros and other very rich people like him who fund the heart of the Democratic agenda and who the administration is completely beholden to, and fellow travelers, including the entire Obama team, who believe in open borders as a philosophical idea, this is a fixed point for them, and the administration isn't allowed to deviate from that. And people know that they cannot do that without risking their wrath, or they're true believers and they believe in this and they're going to do everything possible to implement it.
We're recalling a year from the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the tragic, catastrophic withdrawal from Afghanistan. Last week, Adam Kinzinger tweeted, "Don't let my colleagues pretend today that Trump and Pompeo didn't set in motion the Afghanistan withdrawal. They did. I knew Pompeo in the House. He was a hawk on Afghanistan until Trump. He knew better. He owns this one as well. Trump, Pompeo, and Biden all to blame." Mike Pompeo responded, "Adam Kinzinger repeatedly asked me for a job in the Trump administration, Air Force Sec, ambassador, and for a wife." Yes, we were wiped. "Now attacks our Afghan plan that saw no U.S. fatalities, no Taliban takeover, no Americans left behind. Adam, I enjoyed our work in Congress. What's happened to you? You should know better." I didn't know. First of all, is Pompeo, is he a bit of a matchmaker inside the Beltway? Yes. I don't.
Well, he did have a daughter, but she married somebody else. So maybe Adam's a little.
Yeah, good choice.
You know, maybe
for
maybe
her.
Adam's a little. Yeah.
Yeah. Jilted.
Look, you know, he, I don't want to name. Become people, but you know, having been in Washington for decades now, there are two kinds of people come here. There are people like, I think, Trump and Pompeo who know who they are, and when they come to Washington, and there are people on the left like this too, like Bernie Sanders. You know, when they come to Washington, they remain true to who they are because they knew who they are when they got here.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people, and I don't want to name names, like Adam Kinzinger, who came here, and apparently they had no moral root, and they morph into whatever the town wants them to be. And I've seen this story tens of thousands of times.
Yep.
People seemingly, like, you know, nice, bright young people who come to Washington, D.C. and seem like perfectly nice people, just morph into whatever. It's like some scene out of a 50s horror movie. So, you know, sometimes I have more respect for people like AOC, who I completely disagree with on virtually everything. And I think, honestly, I just think as a person, she's morally reprehensible. She's anti-Semitic, among other things. But at least she's true to who she is. And I don't know what's worse. It's like a movie, you know, it's like the Godfather movies. You know, what's worse, the gangster or the faithful son that turns into a gangster? In the end, they're both gangsters.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, what do you know about the botched assassination attempt on one of Putin's closest allies?
Yeah, I know exactly what you know, which is what's been reported in the media. Definitely doesn't sound like something that the Ukrainians would be behind. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The biggest being it doesn't materially affect the outcome of the war. And Ukraine right now is fighting for its survival. And the amount of resources and risk that you would have to put into an operation like this, I mean, that just doesn't pass the common sense test. You know, who else could be behind it? I don't know. Was her father probably the target? I think that's pretty reasonable to assume. But beyond that, who knows? Look, some of these things, I wouldn't even put it past the KGB for a false flag. I know that just sounds like something out of 24, but with these guys, you never know. I mean, they talking about people who have no moral compass, who knows who's really behind it?
What are we to read from the news that Russia is deploying hypersonic missiles to their positions bordering Poland and Lithuania?
Well, I mean, they've been first of all, they've used hypersonic missiles in Ukraine already. Part of us thinking on that is they're just running out of arsenal. They have been threatening throughout this conflict, and they continue for look to ways to threaten and intimidate their neighbors. So it could be part of that. On the other hand, we have to remember that Putin is a leader who has broken every taboo. So when you say, well, this doesn't make sense, Putin would never do this, he wouldn't actually attack people, blah, blah, blah. We have to remember, Putin is the only guy who has broken every single rule that's out there. He has poisoned dissidents in other people's country. He has invaded countries and given nothing, given, you know, no excuse or really even for it. He has done every imaginable crime there is. You know, it's like there, what circle of hell is that in Dante? Like the 9th or the 10th or the 15th or whatever. There's no room for anybody else in that circle other than Putin, because he's done everything all the other guys have.
So what's the trajectory of the war at this point? What's your handle on where things stand and what, if anything, we should be doing to help Ukraine that we're not?
Well, I think neither side has the military capacity to really bring it to a decisive conclusion. I think that's really clear. Right now, it's particularly confusing because we have situations where the Russians and the Ukrainians are both attacking and defending at the same time in different places. So it's kind of never more, I think, confusing for the average person on the ground. Look, I was in the camp, you know, let's put aside the efficiencies and the corruption and everything else. The quickest way to get this to a point where the war ends was to arm the Ukrainians as quickly and as completely as possible. And I actually think the greatest sin of the administration has just been being incredibly risk averse in arming and the Ukrainians. I think their second greatest crime is, you know, throwing money at the problem. Look, this is a country that's been fighting endemic corruption since it was born. It's only really tried to be an emergent democracy since 2014. And while they're not, they have just not have to fight for their survival, they have to fight for their future. And just dumping money into the country doesn't really help the Ukrainians any more than not giving them military aid. So it seems to me on both ends of this administration has done pretty poorly. I must say on the aid side, as sympathetic as I am with my friends about the corruption in the Ukraine issue, which I totally am, because the Ukrainians don't want this. The Ukrainians do not want corruption. The biggest corruption scandal out there right now is Afghanistan, where a president until just a few weeks ago was trying to negotiate to give, on top of the $7 billion in military equipment the Taliban seized, he was negotiating to give them $7 billion. And just last week announced $30 million in aid, which, you know, we have no visibility over, no transparency, no accountability, that money is going to go in the hands of the Taliban. That is a real foreign assistance scandal of the highest order.
Hmm. And they're not, I mean, they don't let girls go to school anymore. They don't let, I mean, it's awful what they're doing to the women of Afghanistan. And, you know, the Democrats who claim that they're champions of women, they don't seem to be too concerned about it, do they?
No, because they're writing a check. This is $30 million to aid women and gender issues in Afghanistan. And then look, you can't make this stuff up. Yeah. That money gets turned over to some international organization, and we have no visibility on how that money is spent. I would guarantee you that organization has no visibility on how that money is spent. It's going to on the ground, and you know it's going in the hands of the Taliban. Today, Afghanistan actually had a growing economy before Biden left. Today, the Afghan economy consists of two things: foreign assistance and drug money.
Right. And so it's interesting, and no visibility on how money spent, no accountability. But it almost sounds like how we spend money here.
Yeah, it's
how the government spends money here. The dispatching by him, you know, the self dispatch of Dennis Rodman to rescue Brittany Griner. How do you think that's going to go? Could this get just when you think it can't get more ridiculous?
Would it be funny if they like found some reason to throw him in jail? I mean, it would be funny.
But he's good friends with Jim Kong, Young Kim Un. Young, what's his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then
he's friends with Putin. Kim Jong-un. 2014, he said he was cool.
Yeah, then Kim Jong-un does an emergency evac for Dennis Rodman. Yeah.
If you want to talk about really big hostage scandals, we're negotiating an Iran deal now, and the Iranians are going to throw in what they call a hostage exchange, right? So Obama did this too. You know, Obama got the deal, and then part of the deal is they gave us back some hostages. So how come there were more hostages? The Iranians take hostages and then they blackmail us for money. And the Biden administration, you know, the last number I saw of the total benefits that would go to the Iran for signing an Iran deal, which, by the way, won't stop them from getting a nuclear weapon and which will reward them for taking hostages, is $1 trillion. $1 trillion.
No one likes paying extortionists more than the left, it seems. Isn't that interesting? Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP, Catherine Shelby Calm Davis, Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks, as always, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Our friend Professor Richard Epstein and his colleague Michael Rackless wrote a piece in the Journal updating us on Obamaland here, Obama's presidential library. If you've listened to us and the arguments that Protect Our Parks has been making through their counsel, that the Obama team has been relieved of having to follow federal environmental law by
chopping down thousands of trees
by courts of law. Yeah. In addition to that, now we find that contract law does not apply to the Obama Presidential Center team either. You know, when something is politically desired in Chicago, the rule of law is generally suspended. But that's normally where we get oversight from. If you can't get it from the courts locally, you get it from the courts at the federal level. But that's not happening either. So for the latest on all of this, pleased to be joined again by Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to come to talk to you.
So contract law doesn't apply either, particularly as it specifically applies to the amount of money that the Obama Presidential Center was to raise to make this project financially feasible.
Yep. This is a point which I think became clear very early on. What happens is they're trying to build the project, which if you take the last estimate they gave before the inflation rise over a year ago, would probably cost you somewhere around $1.4 billion. And then you look at their endowment and you see that they have a list of total assets, which is put in today at about $700 million. But that number is not a number of endowment. An endowment requires you to have only liquid assets that you could spend on future projects. And they include in their total assets all the monies that they've expended on the half-completed structure. That is the infrastructure you have to put into place, which is very expensive, cost about $85 million at a guess. And then they probably have about, you know, $115 million in actual construction costs. So you have to lop that out. And what you find out is that the asset base is only $500,000, and much of that is in restricted funds dedicated to other projects, and much of that has to be spent to make care of the very heavy internal expenses that the foundation has. So what happens is if you look at this thing, they just don't have the money. Now, when does this matter? Well, in many ways, the current interest is on the current account. But if you're looking at the particular contract, there are things known as conditioned precedents, which means that if you can't satisfy these conditions, you can't close on the deal, you have to postpone it. And one of them said that they have to receive both at the time of their first estimate and then at the day of closing assets in excess of the cost of the foundation. And, well, the foundation claimed that they had received those assets, which was true, arguably in March of 2021. But what it did is it spent them on other things. So they were not dedicated to this project. And they claim it's okay on what you do to spend them. It's only once you raise them, you could spend them on something else, which means that there's no security for the city with respect to this. And then they were required to set up a financial endowment to maintain this operation, which is very expensive. And their own figures in the 2021 report for 2020 put that number at $470 million. And they claim they set up an endowment fund because they put $1 million into it in June of 2021. So the other $469 million have gone empty. But they agreed amongst themselves that this satisfied the deal. So they signed a transaction on August 13th of 2021, and they chopped down all the trees on August 16th. I regard this as just simply a situation in which the city is not only giving the Obama Foundation a huge subsidy in terms of all the legal work they've done and the road work that they're prepared to do and all the rest of that, but now the only way that they'll be able to complete this project is to go hat in hand to some public body in order to raise $1 billion or so in order to make this thing go through.
Maybe they need to get a bigger Netflix deal. But here's the question.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah. If they violate, the conditions precedent in the master agreement, but if the city, the contracting party, doesn't want to enforce that aspect of the contract, then you need a taxpayer lawsuit to intercede?
Yes, I mean, I want to send you to law school, right? What you need to do is you bring a suit as an individual taxpayer who says you are dissipating our assets by exposing us to this liability, or a derivative suit where one person sues on behalf of all the citizens of Chicago. We brought a suit just like that, and we go before Judge Blakey, and literally one day after the papers are filed, he issues a final judgment against us, announcing we can't look at the papers now because we filed the suit as a third-party beneficiary. That is, we filed the suit as somebody who claimed the benefit under the contract rather than somebody who was trying to stop the contract from going forward because they didn't meet the conditions. So now we're in this impossible position. If we win this case, as we should, what will happen is I'll have to rip the whole thing down. I don't want it to go that far, but, to try to get this case out of the district court, now is almost an impossibility because of the complexities associated with the final judgment rule. This thing is still just sitting there after now 8 months, and it's probably going to have to sit down below and on the appeal level, but God knows how long. So I think what really needs to happen is political pressure has to be brought. I think somebody should bring a FOIA action. I think the newspaper should start to inquire. The Obama Foundation has always prided itself on transparency, but this is a completely occult transaction. We do not know at this particular point what the estimates are for the cost of completion. We don't know who it was that authorized the transaction to go forward on August 13th. We have no idea whether the unaudited accounts that were put forward in March were in fact correct, and there was no effort, as they were required to do, to make a financial update as of the date of closing. So the whole transaction from the outside looks to be a shambles, but you cannot get them to engage publicly in dealing about this. If you look at the two last annual reports, it's instructive. The 2020 report has a fairly detailed explanation as to how they're going to have to step up their fundraising to make things go, and that would require them to raise much more in any given year than they've raised in their best year, which was 2017, where they raised about $232 million. But in fact, the contributions are going down. Last year, they only got $159 million, which is a very substantial sum, but not for a project of the size they have. They announced two large gifts from Airbnb and from Amazon or their owners. It turns out those were not gifts to the Obama Presidential Foundation. They were gifts to some other entity, which may be administered by the Obamas, but are not part of the endowment and cannot be reached for these purposes. So we sit there, genuinely puzzled when we wrote the piece for the Wall Street Journal, and you look at the comments afterwards, totally derisive of everything that has been done by the foundation. Even I was stunned at just how powerful the response has been, and the hope is that somebody will, in fact, launch a real inquiry to find out what's going on there, because we cannot get to the books through the conventional legal process.
Some media outlet to dig deep and to FOIA these
Yeah, imagine that, a media outlet doing
in
their
Chicago?
Job.
In Chicago? Yeah. I don't know. That's a big ask.
It is a big ask.
Well, but it is a big ask, but it doesn't have to be Chicago. I mean,
that's true.
You know, the Obamas are nationwide. I mean, if you remember what the ambition was here, they decided no mere library was good enough for the Obamas because the library is governed by a statute called NARA, the National Archives and Research Act, and it can only be 70 feet high. And so this thing is 235 feet high, so they changed it from a library, which is not going to exist except digitally, into a center, and they hope they would be able to replicate it in other places. What's happened is it's been a catastrophe because the thing is taking forever, and now there's some real question as to whether or not they have the resources. I want to also add that we were on to this early on, and nobody who's suing in this particular case just wants to be a naysayer. In fact, we hired a great architect, a man by Graham Balcony, I believe has been on your show.
Yeah.
He put together an alternative site plan for an area on private land just to the west of Washington Park. His design won the AIA, that's the Architectural Association, Prize of the Year for Master Plan. I mean, so it's not a piece of nonsense. It's infinitely superior to the rather static and stagnant building that the Obamas want to put on the lakefront, and they won't even talk about it. Nobody talks about it. The judges don't talk about it. The Obamas don't talk about it. And so what we're doing here is we're seeing this situation in which the entire judicial system has decided not to step up to the challenge. The opinion written by the Seventh Circuit by Judge Wood on the environmental issues was, I think, one of the worst opinions that I've ever read in my life. You cannot find a single opinion anywhere which treats the tree and the migratory bird problem with the insouciance that came out in that particular case. When Judge Barrett argued the case, she completely mangled it as well, and Judge Blakey is not doing a very good job. So what's happened is the political situation is hopeless, and the judicial system, as far as I'm concerned, is not any better. So it seems to me that the Fourth Estate, which is what you guys are, have to step up and try to do something. If transparency is, in fact, the norm, then what you have to do is open the books. And we have been unable to do that through litigation.
With respect to the financing and why, any insight into why you think it's been, relatively speaking, in terms of the scale we're talking here, lethargic, is that just a lack of concern, a lack of sense of urgency because, as you sort of intimated, they feel like they've got a backstop with their friends in city or state government if it came to that?
Well, it may. I can't say for sure whether they think that. Nobody should ever rely on that because appropriations requires independent acts by legislatures, committees, and so forth, and it just can't be done by a single person, either by the mayor or by the president or the head of the Department of Transportation. So I think that would be risky. No, I think what really happened is they thought that brand names last forever. But anybody who's ever been in the show business knows that they depreciate very rapidly. Barack Obama in 2022 is not the same kind of figure that Barack Obama was in 2017, which is why these contributions are going down. Several things happen. One of them is other stars and other issues start to come to the fore, which necessarily push you off center stage. And then they've also made some very serious mishaps in the way in which they've programmed themselves. They're trying to make them appear as though the aids for the poor to help the communities and so forth. You do that by programs. You don't do that by spending $1.5 billion or whatever the number will be
on a
building.
You
can house that program in much more humble circumstances, and you get it moving much more quickly if you decided to build on another site. And so what happens is when you see houses on Nantucket, houses in Hawaii and so forth, and a president leading the grand life after he's out of office, you don't think of him as you do like George Bush, the dreaded George Bush, who basically went back to Texas and painted and has never gotten himself involved in politics again. And it's very complicated to get people to give money to an enterprise which they think, and I think they think rightly, is more interested in the grandeur of the president rather than in the program that he put forward. So if they had done this on a much lower key, I think they would have been able to get, A, more money, and, B, devote more money to the end projects in this case. If you look at the amount of money that's been spent on the project, on the administration, and so forth, and then on the amount amount that's been spent on program. We don't have the exact figures, but I'd be stunned if this were over 20% of the total amount that they've received, and it's probably even less than that. And so the whole thing is essentially malapportioned, and I think that people have finally come to understand that. It is not a wise thing for a president or an ex-president to try to become a pop star and a current celebrity. It simply does not work, given the, you know, the fast nature change of the situation. And it's even harder to do this when you live the high life on the one hand and announce your concern for the civil rights movement, the destitute, the poor, the underrepresented, and so forth. The visual clash that you see between their opulence on the one hand and the plan they're trying to put forward on the other is going to drop people off. And folks who have made one contribution early on are not likely to make another. And if they do make another, it's going to be much smaller than the initial one. That is what accounts for the count. If you look at this in terms of real dollars as opposed to just the nominal dollars, given what happened since 2017, contributions are down 40% on an annual basis or more.
Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate the update. We'll try to get the Fourth Estate roused into action here.
Oh, thank you so much, and best to you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the kangaroo court that Mayor Triple Threat organized to do monument review, this Orwellian collection of the city's deep thinkers.
Yeah, because we, you know, don't focus on violence or anything. Worry about an inanimate object, a statue. And it took them more than a year to come up with their decision.
Well, I'm sure it was robust study, debate, reflection, more debate, very considered. The panel recommending to the permanent removal of three Christopher Columbus statues, as well as the Balboa Monument in Burnham Park. And considering some others, too, just for fun, a couple of the others. The DuSable Bridge reliefs that show the Battle of Fort Dearborn with an allegorical narrative of the triumph of Western civilization. American Indians are used as merely a foil to help define the heroic acts and qualities of colonizing forces. So that's got to go.
I didn't even know it was there.
Tablets dedicated to De La Salle, Jalayette, Marquette at the DuSable Bridge that state the first men to the first white men to pass through the Chicago River. That's of course white supremacist in nature, and so on and so forth. The report says the image of Columbus has become a bitter reminder of centuries of exploitation, conquest, and genocide. Maybe they should check out 1883 or read A Thousand White Women. But I digress. Nick Sposato, 38th Ward Alderman, he's been involved in this fight with the city. He had this to say about the panel's recommendation on Columbus specifically.
We are going to talk on Monday. I just talked briefly with her, 15 minutes ago.
And what did she say?
Well, she just said it, she said, I called you because I basically texted her and said, I'm really pissed off. And that was the extent of it. We need to talk. Monday when you're back, and she called me right now and said, look, I didn't want you to be stewing over this.
That was Sposato being interviewed by Mike Flannery of Fox Chicago. So Sposato and Lightfoot are going to talk today, and what's going to come of that?
Absolutely nothing.
Correct.
Yeah. What do you say? He's got to have some speaks with her. Maybe they could compare things, if you know what I mean.
Ron Onesti is the president of the Joint Civic Committee of Italian Americans and the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame, director of Casa Italia, and director of the Italian American War Veterans Museum. Busy guy. Also the owner of the Arcata and Des Plaines Theaters.
Oh.
Ron, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. So nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. And so your reaction to Mayor Lightfoot, whipping it out and throwing it around and so forth.
Well, you know what, guys, a lot of people are somewhat freaking out over this, at least on our side, about these findings. And, you know, we must remind everybody that, and I'm, believe me, I'm far from defending the mayor in any situation, but these are the findings of the commission and not from the mayor, you know, per se. And frankly, as you know, this is absolutely no surprise. This commission has not wavered in the 2 years that's been working. It's been working on since day one. The 27-3 on the commission have made it very clear that Columbus has got to go, and all those things that they're saying about Balboa and all the stuff that you just spoke about now. Nothing, not one iota of it has changed over the 2 years. So again, seeing this in writing. Is no surprise.
Did they interview anybody from the Joint Civic Community, a Committee of Italian Americans?
Not as and that's one of the things you would have liked. Not as a unit, not as an organization. They had the open forums with, you know, public forums kind of thing, and I spoke and testified on several of those. Our former president Sergio Giangrande, who was a member of the commission, spoke. Alderman Nick Sposato, as you mentioned, he's a member of that commission. He spoke, and that's about it, really. So it was more about, you know, go ahead, spout off, let me hear what you got to say, rather than a productive conversation respecting everybody involved.
So where are the statues now? Who's got them?
So Chicago Park District have them stored in a just a dark warehouse, dirty warehouse on the south side of Chicago.
And so
they let you.
Where do they go? I mean, is there a play here, assuming that the mayor folds in with the recommendations of this Orwellian commission she stood up? Is there, you know, I mean, do you want to put him in front of the theater in St. Charles or give him to...
Maybe the theater in front of Des Plaines?
I don't know, talk to Skip Saviano and have him put in Elmwood Park somewhere? Or, I mean, like, you know, go where they're wanted sort of thing is my question.
Well... You know, that's a very good perspective and point. And Skip, in particular, has mentioned anytime, just bring them to us. No, that has come up in a very real situation. It was an unofficial offer, if I could say that. Say, listen, you know, what if we just give you the statues? But the only caveat here is you cannot put them up anywhere in the city of Chicago. And I had the statue from Arrigo Park for a day, and I chose to give it back to the city. Give back to the Chicago Park District because the terms were not acceptable. It's got to go back where they were originally put in the beginning in 1968, and there's really no wavering on that on our part either.
Well, yeah, wouldn't it be sort of perfectly metaphoric that Columbus is fleeing the city like everyone else?
Well, that's an excellent position, but you know the point here is that. This is far more than Columbus the man or what he accomplished or didn't accomplish or whatever he did. You know, this is about an ethnic group being treated a certain way that no other ethnic group would be treated. Can you imagine taking down a statue of Martin Luther King and not consulting or bringing in the African American community? Taking down something about St. Patrick and not bringing the Irish American community. I mean, it was just taken down without any consideration. It was said it was to be temporary. We just wanted a meeting, and I can tell you the litigation that we have ongoing right now, and pardon me, and everything that's been happening with this, it all comes as a result of just a lack of communication. Because she could say, you know what, you're a pain in the neck. Here, take the. We're going to put the statues up tomorrow. That's not really what we want. We want a security plan, a maintenance plan, a vandalism plan, a vandalism plan. We want to understand, you know, how it's going to be safe for the police, for the statues themselves, and for the people. She just won't meet with us. She'd rather go through this lawsuit situation, which is, you know, with Amy, you made a very good point. You know, it's almost embarrassing, frankly. I mean, look at the resources they're spending on this. You got crime, education, a litany of things that need to be give attention to, and we're spending time on this issue. It's ridiculous.
And lest people forget, too, how this went down. This went down the same way that Daly closed MIGS. Sent the backhoes out there and put X's on the runway. She pulled the Columbus statue out of Grand Park in the cover of night. She just made that decision.
Oh, it was 3 in the morning in a dark July night that Arrigo Park, and they just came with the cranes and police cars and just ripped it off the off the base, and that was one of the things. You know, when I first part of the litigation that we had, you know, one of the terms way back at the beginning was we didn't know where the statues were, and I really wanted to. I demanded, I want to see the statues. Number one, did she destroy them? Are they still? Do they still exist? And I went to. They allowed me to do it with one of our attorneys and with Chicago Park District Attorney. And it was terrible. Went to the warehouse and it was on its side, vandalized with cracks in it from the chains, and it was very symbolic here.
Wow. And so when you get you will get them back, correct? I mean, even if she doesn't want to put them up in Chicago, you can still get them and take them to Stone Park or whatever park you want to.
Or what about the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, believe me.
There's a lot of locations.
Alternative locations is not the problem. I've got hundreds, literally, of people who would take them anywhere and around the country as well.
Yeah.
But should the city pay for the damages that they caused?
Well, you know, the ownership sits, they're fighting that the ownership sits with them. Absolutely. And people say, you know, why should they pay for the security? Should they pay for the safety of it? Well, yeah, I mean, it's their property technically. And it's just like anything else. I mean, that we're here, they should be there to protect it. And that's like, you know, the North Shore, Michigan Avenue, you know, got attacked 3 times plus. Should we just raise all the buildings just to get away from the, you know, or protect them? Same thing here.
And just speak to the larger argument that you touched upon, which is the idea that the argument over the statue is really an argument over how Italian Americans are being treated and their contributions being remembered in the city.
Absolutely. You got to keep in mind that there isn't one Columbus statue that was put up actually to commemorate what Columbus did and all that. Every one of these statues were put up to commemorate the contributions made by Italians and Italian Americans to develop this great city, this great country, and especially in 1891. And also, we can't forget, guys, the historic value as art pieces themselves. The Arrigo Park one was built in 1892 for the 1892-93 Columbian Exposition World's Fair. It was there at the World's Fair. The one at Grant Park was built for the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago. The Balbo Monument. Keep in mind that most people don't even understand what that is. That is an actual 2,000-plus-year-old column from ancient Rome that was a gift from Italy to Chicago to commemorate the aviation heroics by Italo Balbo coming across. It was Italy's answer to Lindbergh, and it was a really big deal. 1 million people lined the shores of Lake Michigan to watch all of this. And they say that, well, that was a fascist thing. The type of government that is happening at Italy in Italy at that time has nothing to do with it. That's got nothing to do with fascism, this monument. This has got to do with ancient Rome.
Well,
from Ostia.
And also, too, I mean, this is like the ignorance of history here from these appointed panelists. Balbo was hostile to anti-Semitism. He opposed Mussolini's alliance with Hitler.
Absolutely. That stuff all came later. That was, you know, 39, 40, 41. This happened in 1933. I mean, this is people have to understand the history and understand the value. Who would want the responsibility? I mean, they would come under international warfare when it comes to trying to take a crane and destroy a column from ancient Rome, trying to move it. I mean, it is ludicrous. And again, we have to give this report the value of just the paper that it's written on, because these are mere suggestions to the mayor. And the mayor has come out, even though she says she's going to reread it and consider. But on May 2nd, she did come out and say, I don't care what the commission says. I do not believe in erasing history, and the statues will go up. Now, she said that.
Yeah.
What happens is what happens. But that's where we're at right now.
All right. Well, you know, the point I would make to these people, too, is, you know, you have to judge people in the time in which they lived, and you better hope, you panelists, you mayor, you better hope you're judged in the time in which you live. Because if you're judged against, you know, absolute perfection, which you're judging other people who have accomplished great things and are seminal figures in the history of human civilization, it is not going to be well that you're remembered. But, you know, I digress. Ron Onesti, president of the Joint Civic Committee of Italian Americans and the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame, director of Casa Italia, and a director of the Italian American War Veterans Museum. He also owns the Arcata Theater in St. Charles and the Displanes Theater as well. Ron, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
I listen to you all the time. Congratulations. It's a great show, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Getting to a point where the discussion of the importance of a liberal arts education is past post because it's no longer possible except through independent study, not through institutional. Not through educational institutions. Christy Olazewski is the director and founder of the Yale Pediatric Gender Program.
I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and I am the director of the Yale Gender Program, which is an interdisciplinary program working with gender-expansive individuals, 3 to 25, and their families. We help individuals who are questioning their gender identity or who identify as transgender or non-binary. We help them with their gender journey, thinking through that, thinking through the risks and the benefits of medical intervention, starting medical intervention, and also building supports around them. And I love what I do, so it's really, really wonderful to be working in this field and to be working with individuals who are gender diverse and gaining their support and helping them on their gender journeys.
Oh, it's wonderful.
From three?
Three-year-old on their gender journey.
Three-year-olds don't even know primary colors to count. Why aren't they focusing on that rather than what gender they are?
That's Yale at Berkeley. A private housing co-op just off the University of California, Berkeley's campus has banned white visitors in common areas without the consent from other tenants. Now, this is a private venture. It's not affiliated with the university, but it is ideologically aligned. The Person of Color Theme House, that's a quote, is a housing co-op located near Berkeley that aims to provide housing to low-income, first-generation immigrant and marginalized students of color. Many POC members, this according to the house rules, many right. POC members moved here to be able to avoid white violence and presence. So respect their decision of avoidance if you bring white guests. White people are not entirely banned from the house's premises, but if you want to bring a honky to the building, you have to notify the other tenants before you do, so they know there's a honky about
like who could be violent.
About to be present. Well, they are violent. Their
presence is
violence.
That's right. So you have to make sure that you're in a safe space and get approval.
Mm-hmm. Firing honky teachers in Minneapolis public schools first, we talked about last week.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Harriott, who's a real race hustler, he writes over at the Griot. He defends this. Firing white teachers is a great idea. Firing white teachers first or only is a great idea. Here's why. Almost every study, black and non-white students have better educational, emotional, behavioral outcomes in classrooms with same race teachers. Sure. Good argument for segregation. Black teachers, black students, white teachers, white students. That's good. They were doing that in Atlanta until black mom sued. In Minneapolis public schools, black and Hispanic students are more likely to be disciplined, less likely to graduate. Oh, right. So they're subject to systemic racism with all those leftists in the Minneapolis public school system. Sure. Minneapolis public school students, 37% white, 34% black, 17% Hispanic. Yet the staff at MPS is 66% white, 18% black, 6.5% Hispanic. So there you go. So that's why it's good to fire the honky teachers first, because they're overrepresented while blacks are underrepresented. Case closed. That's a level of education. One more. I mean, okay. I could go on all
day.
No,
I know, but this is, I find this fascinating.
One more. Right. Education schools have long been mediocre. Now they're woke, too. This is from Daniel Buck, Chalkboard Review. I studied for a master's degree in education at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2015. My program was baddie. We made Black Lives Matter friendship bracelets. This is for a master's degree in education. We passed around a popsicle stick to designate whose turn it was to talk while professors compelled us to discuss our life's traumas. We read poems through the lenses of Marxism and critical race theory. At the time, I figured my experience was unique. Wrong. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty reviewed the required coursework for 14 programs for teachers to be in the state of Wisconsin. Those programs that produce about 80% of all teaching graduates in the state each year. Noticeably lacking academic literature, manuals on classroom instruction. Instead, Hollywood movies like Freedom Writers, which is awful, by the way. Books like Anti-Racist Baby, you know, Ibram Kendi's oeuvre. In place of academic essays, graduate students write personal poems or collect photographs. These kitschy activities infantilize what ought to be a rigorous pursuit of professional competency. Oh, just slightly. Each program exhibits a philosophy of education called critical pedagogy, which is Freire. The envisioned schools as places not of academic instruction but societal change. Yeah, we know this, but we want you to understand how comprehensive it is and how silly it is and how anti-intellectual it is and how little it prepares your kids for success at the next level of education or in the real world. So, I mean, honestly, you read through just a half a dozen of these things, which you could do on any given day, and you're like, what is the point? What is the point? This is why Prager said, and he said at our cigar smoker last week, best thing you can do, get your kid out of government school system. It's the best thing you can do for your kid and for the country. It's getting increasingly difficult to disagree. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Agresto. He's the former president of St. John's College. He served in senior positions at the National Endowment for the Humanities as well. He's got a new book, The Death of Learning, How American Education Has Failed Our Students and What to Do About It. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Well, the failures are manifest and multitudinous. So what should we do about just some of the smattering of what you've heard?
I think we just have to go back and try to understand what education is for, especially what a liberal education is for. I mean, we know what an education in agriculture school is for. It's to turn out people who know how to farm, know how to produce things we eat. We know what an engineering school does. It turns out engineers, civil, mechanical, etc. What's a college for? What's a university for? Well, I tell you one thing. What it's not for is to indoctrinate kids into political views. It's to teach them to have some respect for facts and ideas. And the more it can do that, and it can do that through having them read wonderful books, not read books that are in line with the current or left or right political ideologies, but read good, I'm sorry to say, old-fashioned books. Read things like Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird and The Iliad and The Odyssey. Read things in American history. Like, read the Constitution. Don't either say it's a divinely inspired on one hand or a piece of garbage on the other, a racist document on the other. Read about it. And then the other thing you could do is you could have your kids talk about it in class. It's amazing that if you get kids to talk, how interested they get in learning.
And why, you know, you wrote an article about why call it liberal education when why not call it conservative education? Why don't they do that?
let's say it could be called either because it is both. Liberal education, I think, is called liberal because it liberates the mind. What does it liberate the mind from? From whatever's current, whatever's political, whatever's in the winds, whatever our parents, teachers, friends, and the internet think, we say, you know, you might be right. Could I look at it for a bit? Could I see what you're saying? And could I see what the other side is saying? So a liberal education is aims at the liberation of the mind of our students. It's also conservative because it conserves the best books and music and art that's ever been done. And, you know, it gets into a lot of trouble because it tries to conserve things like Beethoven and Mozart rather than hip-hop and rap. But that's okay. You know, it's an education that says we will look at the best that's been thought and said and done, and we'll also look at the worst that's been done. We'll teach history, teach it straight. We'll teach literature. We'll teach philosophy, and teaching philosophy means that we're going to teach Plato and Aristotle. We're going to teach Locke and Hobbes. We're going to teach Darwin and Nietzsche. Okay. Now, some of this isn't age appropriate for grade kids, of course, maybe not even for high school kids. But certainly in college, if you go to a good liberal arts college, your mind will be you will be taught rather than lectured to. And people will learn how to teach rather than to propagandize. That's all I meant by that.
A good liberal arts college. How many of those are left?
Oh, jeez. Come on, put me on the spot here.
Yeah,
Dan.
I know.
What can
I
you
mean,
think of? Like,
I mean, I could maybe name 10 that I think could fit that. But
there, wait, what are they?
But there's 3,000 colleges. That's not very many.
No. Yeah, there are. The truth is, number one, colleges, why colleges want to become universities and universities want to become multiversities, I have no idea.
Mm.
Colleges are, that's a good traditional conservative name for a place where people get together and learn together. How many of them are, I think you could say there are 10, probably more than 10, truly great colleges in America. Then there are a smattering of very good colleges with a good political science department, but you know a bad literature department, with a good language department, but a bad philosophy or no philosophy department.
Yeah.
A place, yeah. So the trouble is when you talk about colleges, universities, you got to start talking about the offerings within them. You were talking, I heard while I was waiting on the phone, about schools of education. They are uniformly bad.
Yes.
I'm sorry to tell you that.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that political science departments are uniformly bad. And in fact, I think since the 1960s and 70s, many of them have gotten much better.
Well, I mean, let me ask this a different way, because, you know, you get this a lot talking to parents with kids that are, you know, starting to look at colleges or make the decision on which college to go to or to go to college at all. If you have a kid who's prepared to do intellectual battle, like I was, but went before I went to college, but I mean, I still had much to learn. I still do, but I was prepared. I had like a grounding. I knew what I was in for when I went to Northwestern, and Northwestern 30 years later is much worse than it was when I went.
Mm-hmm.
But so would you say, if your kid is ready to do intellectual battle, send him to, send him to one of these schools that has completely lost their mind, like any Ivy League school, for example, or would you say send him to Hillsdale?
Well, I went to a private Catholic liberal arts college. It became much better after I left, but I don't think that was causal. But I'm not positive. And then I went to Cornell, which is an Ivy League college. And I have to tell you, my high school education was better than my college education, but my graduate school education at Cornell was better than my undergraduate education. But that's because I majored with people, you know, they may even know the names of your audience, people like Alan Bloom,
Sure.
like Bernard Danhauser, people like Walter Burns, people who would say, we're going to read these things because they're important. It's important for you to know them. You may agree in the end or you may disagree in the end. It doesn't matter to me whether you agree or disagree. You just have to know it. I envy the people who teach physics, who teach the second law of thermodynamics.
they don't care if you agree with it or disagree with it. They just want you to know it. And so I would like kids to know the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and American constitutional history. I'd like them to know what the Bible says. I'd also like them to know what Thomas Aquinas and Dante say. I'd like them to know what Nietzsche, Darwin, and Marx say. Yeah. I'd like them to know these things.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like them to have to read Closing of the American Mind to get into Cornell. How about that?
I have a lot in the book on my friend Alan Bloom of happy memory. He really was a wonderful, wonderful professor. But you know who his best friends were? His best friends were people in the SDS. He thought they were a bunch of criminals, but at least they wanted to know what the truth was, and he could respect that. And when the SDS went after all the conservative, quote-unquote, professors, they always left Bloom alone because, A, they were afraid of him, and, B, they knew they could say what was on their mind, and he would argue with them and not just shut them down. It was a kind of mutual, not fear, but mutual respect there. I talk about that in the book a little bit. I thought Alan Bloom was a marvelous teacher.
Great.
But in some ways, Alan Bloom got us off on the wrong foot because he talked all the time about how the schools are infected with relativism. And I got to tell you, where do you see relativism on colleges and universities? All I see is ideology. All I see is passion. All I see is enthusiasm for this view or that view. All I see is shutting down. I don't see relativism.
John Agresto, former president of St. John's College, served in senior positions at the National Endowment for the Humanities. The new book, The Death of Learning, How American Education Has Failed Our Students and What to Do About It. John Agresto, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.